You're listening to The Gentleman's Guide to Midnight Cinema with Big Willie and the Samurai, bringing class to trash since 1977.
All right, everybody, welcome to the GGTMC. We are back. We are not live, but we are alive, and we're hanging in there.
Yeah.
Daily. This week, it's me and the Totter. We're coming to you for a little Arrow coverage. We haven't done an Arrow show in a little while. This week, we're covering... let me grab the actual disc here. Microwave Massacre from, I believe it was... 83, wow. And Vamp from 1986. Interesting side note, Vamp's actually been on the roadmap for us to cover almost since the very beginning. So finally getting this thing covered after all these years. I just want to give everybody a heads up if you're going to be at the... Horror Hound Weekend in March, right around the 17th, 18th, 19th. I'll be there for those who listen to the show and are interested in meeting me. Will not be there. Todd will not be there this time. But I will be there. I'll be the sole representative. But many of the people that you've heard over the years on the show and close friends will also be there. So we're a very open group, both conversationally and sexually. So make sure you... No. Well, that's only somewhat true. You can ask Todd.
Cammy don't mind if he pinches ass every now and again.
Yeah. But I will be there at a little bit of a personal appearance. It'll be fun to hang out with some folks. Some folks coming in from the West Coast that I haven't seen in 5 years, so it'll be fun to see everybody. Really, that's all I got as far as housekeeping. Let's get into what we watched, blah, 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 this past week. I'll kick it over to you while I drink some of this warm, delicious coffee.
Let's see. Did a rewatch of 1968, The Green Slime. This has always been a fun one for me. The first time I ever saw it, I was hallucinating with the flu when I was a kid. So yeah. It's always one of those things that just stuck with me. It's being really bizarre.
So you actually had some green slime.
I did.
Why you watch Green Slime? Yeah, I don't know if anybody's ever claimed that before. That's interesting.
But it really doesn't get less weird when you watch it, you know, completely alert. It's the Green Slime. You really kind of have to see it to believe it. The lead's pretty much a dick, but Richard Jekyll's, you know, in there, and he's doing his thing, Luciano Paluzzi. And, of course, directed by Kinji Fukasaku. One of his more famous films, I think.
If only for
being as culty, if you will, as it is than anything else. But it's fun. I like it. I enjoy it. It's a nice little siege movie, you know, in outer space with the cheap rubber monsters and people getting fried and all that kind of thing. So, 2008's The Wave I caught up with, which is about a teacher in Germany who is doing this project week where he's going to teach a class on autocracy. And he gets all these kids in there, and they basically become a little fascist group inadvertently. It's based on the premise, you know, it can never happen here again, which I'm sure is something that they kind of have to deal with, you know, even just in the back of their minds, I guess. But not being German, I honestly couldn't speak to that directly. But it's a pretty good movie. It's pretty interesting. All the characters are fairly well defined. And it's mostly believable, more or less. There's, of course, the kid that you could spot from the beginning that's gonna take this all a little bit too seriously, and he's kind of the Paul Dano of the group. It's got a interesting ending. It does raise some questions. It doesn't necessarily answer them, although you could clearly see where the filmmaker's coming from. So it was good. Yeah, no, definitely worth a watch. Caught up with Hard Target 2, which is it's an action movie with Scott Adkins. And yeah, it's a Scott Adkins action movie.
Yeah.
That's about all you could say about it. It's really nothing great to speak of.
Yeah, I love Scott. I like Scott Adkins a lot.
I don't really have too much experience with him, to be honest. Yeah. I mean, I know everybody loses their shit over him, and he does well enough. But yeah.
I don't know. There's something about his movies though that's missing. I mean, yeah. I like him, I really do. But there's something about his movies. Every time I've watched one, I'm just like, it's just not quite all there. Some lack of charisma or something for me.
Yeah, yeah. Well, he's kind of got a lot of one-liners in this one.
Mm-hmm.
He's kind of trying to be a little bit too cutesy. Yeah. Rona Mitra is in here, and she's kind of not great. And the camera work is absolutely horrible.
Yeah.
The settings are nice. The locations are nice. And some of the action's okay, but the camera, the editing, and the kind of basic tone are just kind of like, whatever. I mean, it's not horrible. It's strictly middle of the road as far as I'm concerned. Went from there to Shane Black's The Nice Guys, which I really, really, really liked.
Nice.
I didn't quite like it as much as Kiss Kiss Bang Bang. I think it's kind of a mashup of Last Boy Scout and Kiss Kiss Bang Bang.
That's a good thing.
I think Ryan Gosling really, really outshines Russell Crowe in this. I think it's trying to subvert a few things about, you know, action, this kind of, you know, action detective kind of genre. But at the same time, the way that it does that also makes it just a little bit unsatisfying once you get to the ending.
Mm-hmm.
Have you seen The Nice Guys?
I have not seen it yet. There's this cram thing we typically do, and I've been crammed the other way, which seems to be repulsed by my list of the films I need to watch. Every time I get an opportunity, I just don't have enough time. So it was actually on my list to watch because it made some top 10 list.
But it's definitely, it's good. It's good in the realm of Shane Black movies. It's in fact very good, I'd say, but there just seemed to be something not quite fully clicking in it for me. Like just something I didn't get enough out of it, or as much out of it as I would have liked to have gotten, as far as the satisfaction level. But it's still very good. I mean, don't take that as me taking mm-hmm. a shit on it or anything. Went from that to 1958's The Ballad of Narayama, which was absolutely insanely gorgeous, beautiful, beautiful film. It's the way that it's told is basically like kind of like a kabuki thing where the you have the narrator singing in the background, and you have the guitar thing, I don't know what it's called exactly in Japan, that they kind of pluck going off all the time. And it's a story about an old woman and her family, and she's getting to the point where in this village, once you reach a certain age, you're supposed to go up to this mountaintop to die. And it's about her getting towards that time and dealing with her family and making sure that they're well off, and it's, I mean, it, this thing is stunningly gorgeous, and, you know, a little bit heartbreaking, but just 100%, you know, outstanding, very, very, very much worth seeing. I'm told that in, I think, the early 80s, Shohei Imamura made a remake of it. And I know that, you know, guys like CDR say that it's even better than this, which would be a tough thing to top. But I also think it would be a completely different movie in the same way that Miike's Harakiri is the same thing, but very, very different from the original. So I'm looking forward to that. I put it on my watch list, so hopefully I'll get to it this year. You never know. Yep. But yeah, high recommend for Ballad of Narayama. Rewatch of 1991's Rikkyo, story of Ricky, and yeah, I mean, this is Lam Nam Choi's.
Yeah, either love it or you hate
best
it.
Best ever. Yeah. Oh my God, this thing is, it's nuts from the word go, yeah. And it just never stops. One of the most violent, bloody, gory, funny, fun movies. It flies by, and it does everything great, and plus it has, Yukari Oshima in it, so that's always a good thing as well. Went from that to 1981's The Duel of the Century from Shaw Brothers. This one is really good. This is when Shaw Brothers had the really, really flashy costumes, like almost disco-y kind of kung fu costumes going on. Mm-hmm. And it's good. There's about a million characters in the film. So if you're not paying attention for even a second, you're going to lose the thread. But basically it's about these two guys are supposed to be having a duel, and everybody's kind of trying to figure out why they're having a duel and what's going on. And the lead character is really, he's one of the, you know, the heroes of the martial arts world. And he is trying to figure out what's going on. And he's really, you know, he's really charming. I can't remember who played him off the top of my head. But he's, you know, super charming. He really, you know, keeps the film moving along nicely. And whenever he's on screen, it's fun to watch him go. It becomes a bit formulaic to the point that, you know, you're just sitting there waiting for, okay, now they're going to go to this place and get attacked by these guys. Okay, now they're going to go to this place and get attacked by these guys. But it's got some inventive stuff in there, and it's worth seeing. Not top tier Shaw, but, you know, nice, fun. And finally, I went to the theater and saw that their Logan movie.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, caught it. It's pretty good.
Nice.
In the realm of X-Men films, it's, you know, in the top three, I'd say. I don't know 100% where I'd put it. I'd probably say it's number two in the top three.
Nice.
First Class is still my favorite. I mean, I love First Class.
Yeah, that was really good.
The pieces, yeah. But this one's good. It's not. It has problems. Obviously, it's going to have problems. I don't think there's anything in this film that you don't expect to be in this film, to not be in this film. I think I just screwed up the wording on that. There's nothing in this that's unexpected. And that's perfectly okay, you know, for a film. You know, I understand that. Mm-hmm. But it just – it hits the beats, and it just hits them, and then it moves on.
Good way for Hugh Jackman to sign off on the character?
Oh, I think – it is. The thing is that I never felt – overly emotionally involved with anything that was going on. I know some people are like, you know, oh, the hairs on your arm will stand up, and oh, it's all this stuff. This just didn't hit for me. The little girl who plays X-23 is outstanding.
Nice.
You know, without saying anything, she does a really nice job, I think. And then she starts talking towards the middle. And it's I don't know. I was expecting this to be more like The Nice Guys, but, you know, at the end of the world, if that makes any kind of sense.
Yeah. Okay.
Especially with the way that it's done with between Logan and Professor X, because they're just two cranky old men, you know, kind of going on a road trip with this little girl. The villains are pretty weak. Boyd Holbrook is good as Donald Pierce, but I mean, overall, they just don't really pose that great a threat. I didn't think, and they're not really used as effectively as I think they could have been. I liked it. I liked it a lot. I wanted to like it a lot more. and it's still good. I don't want to say, you know, it's not recommended. I would recommend it, but it just didn't bowl me over like I was expecting it to be bowled over. Where I was expecting, you know, the Dark Knight Returns, perhaps, or, you know, Old Man Logan, you know, the comic, the comic book by McNiven and, who was it? Miller, Ellis, or I can't remember who wrote it off the top of my head. I was expecting that, and it didn't quite give me that. It just kind of gave me every beat that that's the thing that really kind of gets me about it. I was just expecting a little bit more out of it than, okay, now they meet a family of farmers, so now they're going to do this. So now they meet these guys, so now they're going to do that. And then there's things that are left unexplained, which I could kind of see why they did that. I get it, but at the same time, I would have liked to have dipped into that a little bit more because I think it might have given it a little bit more depth than it gave me. So we'll see it whenever, you know, if they come out with a director's cut down the line, if that gives more or makes it better or makes it worse. But it's definitely worth seeing, and it's definitely worth seeing in a theater. So
nice.
And that's it for me, brother. Kick it over to you.
Nice. Yeah, I was curious if anybody I knew, you know, outside of, you know, the general Facebook group and all the friends I have out there, if anybody I remotely talked to had seen it. So, yeah, that's interesting. Some people had compared it to a superhero slash spaghetti western in some ways.
Kind of. Well, I think the oddest comparison that I saw was saying that it's a Peckinpah film, and I'm like, no, I didn't get that out of it.
Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe I'm old and jaded. Maybe I'm, you know, more like Logan than I'd like to be. I don't know. But I mean, that's the thing. It's over two. It's 2 hours and 15 minutes long, and you know, by the time you get to the end, you're feeling it.
Yeah,
because it's so, you know, he's so fucking miserable through the whole thing, and I get it. I get the point of that, but I think that shaving about a good 25 minutes off of this thing would really kind of, you know, keep the pace up and just, you know, keep it from bogging down in its own misery. Which it's part of the world that they put them in for this, so I get that. But at the same time, it doesn't make it that much easier to get through or to live with for that length of time.
Yeah. I was never the biggest X-Men fan as a comic reader growing up. It got convoluted
for
me.
A few years.
Yeah, I mean, I had my time. And it just got so convoluted after a while and so out of whack, and I couldn't keep up. I mean, and of course, you know, there's so many crossovers and all this good stuff. Anyway, once the movies came out, I was like, well, you know, I never really got into the comics that much. I'm going to avoid the X-Men movies. But once I started watching them, overall, I always thought Hollywood in general has done a pretty good job with the X-Men characters and the franchises. And even though I would like to see Wolverine full bore, you know, maybe not Sin City, but, you know, maybe somewhere in between that and maybe where Logan stands. You never really feel like, I mean, I always kind of feel like comic book movies are still made for, you know, people between the ages of, well, I guess 13 and 21, I guess, but I guess it's
just this one's a little more mature than that, I think.
Yeah, well, that's good. I mean, I guess for me, you know, just the older I've gotten, the more interested I am in the, well, I'm just more interested in watching people kill people and eat them in microwaves, I guess. No. But I am, I mean, generally, I'm more interested in, you know, things that, you know, aren't really that exciting cinema-wise. Marital strife, simple, you know, murder tales, simple human.
I think that you can have those sorts of things. You can do different things in the superhero genre. Obviously, you can.
Yeah, no doubt.
I think they don't because, you know, they're putting so much money into these things that they have to reach the widest possible.
Yeah, you got to make your money back.
Audience, which also equals, unfortunately, a lot of times lowest common denominator.
Yeah, well, it equals.
So
people
I understand
that, gonna,
that but, you know, look at something like Deadpool, which went, you know, completely batshit and was successful.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I you know, and I was surprisingly, I was one of the people that was going to avoid Deadpool, and I watched it, and I enjoyed it quite a bit.
Yeah.
I had a good time with it. Really? I've never been a big Deadpool guy. I mean, always a great looking character, such as the case with a lot of Rob Liefeld's creations. But, you know, I was like, I just don't really like that character. It's too much fourth wall breakage, and I was like, that movie's going to be way over the top fourth wall, and I'm just not going to be able to handle it. But it was the right casting. It was made well. And it was generally, I got to say, quite funny. I laughed quite a bit.
Yeah, yeah. Deadpool never, ever. I still to this day couldn't give two shits about him in a comic book. But yeah, the movie I like.
Yeah.
I'm looking forward to the second one, I'll be honest.
I bought it. So there you go. I mean, that's always a good sign for me. I mean, if I buy your movie, then I quite enjoyed it. So.
Yeah.
Because I'm going to watch it again, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I didn't watch much. I watched a couple things. Again, my year's off to a slow start, very busy. I've watched, I don't know, how many movies have I watched in February? I watched five. And you just named more movies than that. So, it's just, and I'm not watching any television or nothing, guys. It's just I've been so damn busy, and I got a lot of projects going on at my job, and anyway, it's still, movies are a great release for me. When I get a chance to watch them, it's just I have very little time, so I have to watch what I am mostly interested in, which, as you would expect from me, is two documentaries this week. Author, the J.T. Leroy story I watched. This is pretty good. This is interesting. I think this is more interesting from the aspect of this person's psyche than anything. I had high hopes that this would make my top 30 for the year. I don't think it'll be that because there's some things missing, although it will come close. But this is a very good documentary about maybe, and I'm still kind of tussling with this in my head a little bit, the fine line between mental health and art as an artist. There's just something not quite right about this whole thing. But at the same time, it kind of makes sense. So I don't want to go into too much detail.
When you say not something not quite right, do you mean as far as
it almost feels like
presented or
no? The film is great. Just I think the lead, I think there's something almost con artisty about this person, and I'm trying to I don't remember her name off the top of my head. I never read the J.T. Leroy stuff.
No, me
So there's something almost con artist about this in a way that
almost Kaufman-esque.
Yeah. That is bothersome to me because I'm very much a person that, you know, not that I don't judge, but at the same time I like to believe that I'm an honest person, and you know, this gets carried too far. And in some ways that's kind of interesting though. It's kind of a social experiment in some ways, but the way the lead comes off, the individual that was behind the J.T. Leroy thing, it comes off almost a little bit snobbish or pompous in some way for me. It was a little bothersome to me. But anyway, check it out. It's definitely worth a look. I would definitely say check it out. The only other thing I watched was Catholics versus Convicts. Great title. It's a story about it's a documentary about the infamous T-shirts that were made back in I don't remember what year it was, but anyway, it was when the Miami Hurricanes had a football team, and they were always in trouble because they always had a bunch of infractions and kids that were always in trouble, and then the Notre Dame kids who were making a comeback, and you know, of course, you know, if you're Notre Dame, these it's really more of a story of individual, I guess, industrial business than it is more the football game itself, but it's kind of interesting to see. There is a racial dynamic here. You know, Notre Dame being a mostly white American school, Miami being a very heavily African American laden football team. There is a racial quotient here. Not that there wasn't any African Americans on the Notre Dame team, but it's funny how sometimes things like that can be overlooked in the sense of, you know, wanting to make an insult to the other team, you know, you forget that you might be insulting your own players. So, very interesting.
By the way, Catholics versus Convicts would make a very good pinky violence title.
Yeah, it would.
Or a nice video series on Brazzers.
Yeah, I was thinking the same thing. Actually surprised that doesn't happen. And
we'll give it time.
$1 million idea. Somebody from Brazzers listen to the show right now. There's not enough religious iconography.
Iconography.
Jesus. Oh man, I got a thick tongue this morning. Anyway, that's all I really watched. Didn't really get into much else. I'd planned on watching some more of the Arrow stuff. I did watch the documentary on Vamp and on that disc, and I planned on watching the actually because I was interested in the behind the scenes story on Microwave Massacre, but I planned on watching more of those special features, but didn't get around to it. So we'll maybe talk about that a little bit. If you watch any of them, we'll maybe talk about that in the reviews a little bit. So, that's it for the opening of the show. We're going to take a short break. We'll come back and we'll discuss, we'll just go chronologically. Let's do Microwave Massacre first, and we'll be right back.
If you like westerns, comedies, foreign films, horror movies, action adventure, and classic cinema, well, we don't have much of that, but if you like ass, titties, farting, burping, puffy nipples, poop, taboo porn, muffin tops, comic books, wrestling, mustaches, pie smashed on butts, cheese, taking baths, butt sex, gagging, milk, and the American flag, check out the Silva and Gold Podcast. We're the morons your mom warned you about while she was sitting on your face.
Silva and Gold. We talk about movies and shit. Find us on iTunes or silvaandgold.com.
Cheers.
right, everybody, welcome back. All right, so our first film we're talking about this week for good old Arrow Video, they released, this was a bit of a surprise for me, actually, when they released it. And we're not concurrent or current, whatever you want to say, with the release schedule. We've kind of put a lot of stuff on the back burner as far as Arrow Video goes, but we, you know, we'll catch up as we go along. I kind of like that we're not, though, because usually they send us the disc quite ahead of time. And, you know, some people might get excited that these exist and stuff, but they don't exist for a couple months or sometimes weeks after we review them. But this one is available now. It's called Microwave Massacre, 1983, directed by Wayne Berwick, who didn't direct anything else, really, I think. I think this was, well, yeah, he directed The Naked Monster, which, yeah, that sounds about as good as it probably is. I don't know. I'd have to see it, though, you know, never know.
Well, I think his dad, I did watch the documentary on this one, and it's pretty good. But I think his dad was a guy that had worked in Hollywood as a script director for a long time, and I believe... his dad is also the guy that made the Monster of Piedras Blancas.
Oh, yes, yes.
Which is one of those ones that I is more iconic as an image than it is as a film.
Yes.
I know I haven't seen it yet. I'm looking forward to it. I've always kind of hovered around the new Blu-ray that came out a little while ago.
That's right. I've never seen that movie either, but I've always kind of been Irvin Berwick.
Yeah, because he walks around with those fucking gigantic claws, that weird nose, and he's always got a head in his hand, right? Well, how could you not want to see this? But yeah, no, that was his dad. I don't think that Wayne did too much else. Yeah.
Yeah.
Just those few things.
His dad worked on a lot of things, and the crew worked a lot of dialogue director, dialogue coach. That was what he
there
did.
You go. There
a
you
lot
go.
Of that stuff in the 40s and 50s. Looks like he only directed a few things. Malibu High was the last thing. I think I've seen that.
I don't remember if I've seen Malibu High or not.
I think I have seen that. You know, I'm quite a fan of those. You know, those teen films from the early 80s and mid 80s.
Was Malibu High more like a slashery kind of thing?
No. I think it was more like a pre Fast Times at Ridgemont High type deal.
Okay.
But not bad. I mean, it's not bad for that kind of thing. I'm just looking at some of the other stuff his dad made. Hitchhike to Hell, great title there. The Street Is My Beat. 1966. So Monster of Piedras Blancas was his first film.
Okay.
And he made five more after that. Six more after that. So he did seven films, Irv Berwick did.
More than I did.
Yeah.
The two that Wayne did is more than I did. So.
Yeah. He's more than I even got around to starting.
Yeah.
Anyway, Microwave Massacre, like I said, 1983. Nice, crisp 74 minutes, I think, 76, 75, somewhere in there. But basic plot synopsis. Fed up with his wife's bad cooking, Donald kills her and turns to cannibalism to satisfy his appetite. The whole time I'm watching this, I'm thinking, dude, you know, there's, you know, maybe it wasn't the case, but I'm pretty sure it was. There's fast food, you know, you don't have to eat your wife's cooking if you don't like it, Jesus. In his defense, though, I mean, she gives him one of the worst sandwiches in cinema history for his lunch.
Oh, yeah.
Which we'll talk about here shortly. We didn't really pick who was going to lead on this. I can lead on it. You can lead on it. Whichever one you want to lead on.
It doesn't matter to me. Whatever you want to do.
Well, hang on one second. Let me get a drink of my coffee. Yeah. All right. I can lead on this one. I got some pretty good notes on this, I think.
I don't really have a ton of notes for either one, to be perfectly honest.
Yeah. And these are pretty – both these films this week are pretty basic 80s horror kind of ripoffs. Not really, well, I don't want to say ripoffs, but they're basic, very simple horror films, stuff you've seen before and in different kind of interpretations. So nothing super original here. I will say this, the Microwave Massacre box art has always been quite memorable. It's one of those video, if you went to the video store and if you're of a certain age, you probably saw this video cover. I think it came in a large box, if I remember right.
I believe so. Yeah, it might even have been was it a Gorgon or?
I can't remember.
I don't remember. But yeah,
remember
I do remember.
Company,
do seem to remember it being a large box VHS.
Yeah, it was a large box VHS, and it was one of those ones that I would circle around and be like, "Hey, you know, this cannibal movies, quote unquote, and me are not always the best of friends." And when I say that, I don't mean it in a bad way. I do think there's some really good ones, and I think there's some really bad ones, and I think there's some really good implied ones. Mm-hmm. I think it's a basic fear or horror or terrible thing that we're all kind of repulsed by but kind of fascinated by.
Yeah.
But it doesn't always work in horror movies as well as I think they think it will, but I think it's an easy thing to fall on.
Trope. I think that some movies have done it very, very, very well, like Ravenous.
Sure, sure.
The Hills Have Eyes, kinda.
Mm-hmm. That does it. No, I think it does a very good job.
You know, obviously the
Texas Chainsaw Italian Massacres and
yeah, yeah. I think that this movie is this movie is more Eating Raoul than Texas Chainsaw Massacre, though, to be perfectly honest.
Yeah. I should differentiate something though. There is a difference between the cannibal genre from Italy and the cannibal genre from America.
Right? Oh yeah, leaps and bounds.
It seems like in our case, we always have a little comedy or dark comedy, or there's some type of layer that we're commenting on. Whereas the Italian films are very much more, the layer they're commenting on is very much more serious,
more cynical,
and more cynical. And so there is a big difference between the two. So I'm not going to try to say that roping those two together is exactly the same, because it is kind of different. But
yeah,
I will say that a lot of the American-made cannibal films, except for some of the ones you mentioned there, because some of the ones you mentioned there are some of the best, and some of the great horror films of all time, right? I mean, The Hills Have Eyes kind of goes up and down in people's thoughts as years have gone on, but it's still pretty good and pretty well made. Actually, we'll cover it at some point. Arrow put out a copy of that. So
yeah.
But this genre just kind of got overplayed after a while, and this one is. This one's a little bit of a horror comedy. I guess comedy is kind of a loose word, depending on how much you like Jackie Vernon.
I think this is much more a comedy than a horror.
Yeah.
This is more like, I mean, like I said, more Eating Raoul or even Attack of the Killer Tomatoes than it is.
Yeah, it gets a little gross in spots, like Eating Raoul.
Yeah.
But kind of absurd gross, you know, kind of ludicrous.
I think that the more of the grossness comes from the way that people act than anything else.
Well,
because man, everybody in this is a fucking pig.
Yeah, everybody's horny.
Oh my god, horny Jesus. Oh, I've seen 14-year-olds that, you know, have less hormones going on than these fucking guys.
As Will would always quote me saying, lots of fucking, lots of bush. All that going on in here. I think one of my notes is this is made during the era of, you know, male-driven films without prejudice, you know, that nobody's going to comment on the fact that you are basically making a chauvinistic type film, because nobody was really bringing that up at this time. There might have been a small group bringing that up, but not in film and entertainment. So there was a lot of.
Well, it also helps the movie slot in a little bit towards the porno chic kind of thing that was kind of dying out at this point.
Yeah.
You know, the popularity of it as far as going to a theater and it being quote unquote respectable, right?
Yeah. But this one does, I mean, with that being said, it does have some fun moments in it. And obviously it is of its era, so we will have some good time talking. Now, when I mentioned Jackie Vernon a little while ago. Now, Jackie Vernon, most of you would probably not know his face. If you do, then, you know, you're of a certain age group and all that good stuff. But you will, I guarantee, know his voice. Jackie Vernon is infamously or famously known as the voice of Frosty the Snowman from the animated specials that probably so many of us grew up on.
Happy birthday!
Yeah, there you go. There's that first Jackie Vernon impression.
First and worst.
That's a pretty good one. That's a pretty good one. But when you hear him in this movie, a lot of his delivery is so Frosty the Snowman-ish that it was, excuse me, it was almost disturbing in a weird way. And I was like, wow, I mean, Frosty's really gone over the top here. He does have some great lines in the movie for me. My favorite is when she turns out the light to set the mood on me. He's like, it's no use, May. I've already seen it.
Yeah, that was a good one.
That was actually, you know, I got a chuckle out of that. That was a pretty funny line. But he's more of the kind of, what was the name of the other Jackie that was popular? I can't remember the comedian's name. He was in Caddyshack too.
Jackie Mason.
Yeah. It's kind of that kind of humor, kind of deadpan one-liners, stuff like that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And that's this movie. I mean, it's constant barrage of one-liners from everybody. And
some of them work, some of them don't.
But yeah, I mean, it's just, it's, I mean, this guy, the character Donald, it just there's no thought that he leaves unsaid.
Yeah,
zero. I mean, he talks to himself constantly through the movie.
Yeah, he does.
I can't believe there's, you know, it's. I didn't write down any of the quotes because there are so many. I just after like the first 10 minutes of them, I was just like, I can't fucking keep up with this. So I just stopped.
I think at one point he says, "I'm so hungry I could eat a whore."
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That was a good one. But yeah, I mean, if you're not, and this is even, you know, they brought this up in the documentary, and I completely agree with it, is that let's be perfectly honest, the movie is dumb.
Yeah.
You really have to give yourself over to it. And I think that you know this, like, almost immediately from the first scene. I mean,
oh yeah, from the opening credits.
Everybody posts about that infamous or famous whatever opening credit shot, you know, where the microwave massacre over some chick's bobbing titties as she's walking down the street.
Yeah.
I mean, that is the summation of the movie.
That is. That is, and you know, he goes as far as to have a boob cutout in the wall,
perfectly sized
for the lady's boobs to get in there. That actress, yep. I think, is her Knot Hole Girl, Marla Simon, Knot Hole Girl. That's what they call her in the movie, in the credits.
I've seen videos like that.
She worked on two movies.
They call them something different, though.
Yeah, she worked on two movies. This, and she was the assistant director on The Jar from 1984.
Oh God, I haven't seen that. I haven't even thought about The Jar, and I don't know how long.
Yeah, so she's worked on that as well. But she does have a nice set of
things
that you know. Without sounding piggish, I mean, I am a man, and I do remember the opening. That is the scene that I remember the most from this movie. And I'm just going to be frank and honest with everybody right now. As piggish as it might sound, when I was a kid, I loved the opening of this movie. And I still love the opening of this movie at 43 because it does set the tone for the whole movie. If you can get behind the stupidity of a girl getting her breast stuck in a hole, and not only that, them getting loose, and then a guy can see them from 100 yards away, two guys can,
yep,
and they're running and drooling to get a hold of these breasts. Mm-hmm. If you can get behind that level of comedy...
Well, the guy on the other side of the fence gets behind it, so...
Yeah. If you can get behind that level of comedy, then you can get into this movie. Yeah. If that bothers you, then you're probably never going to like the movie, because the movie the movie is pretty piggish. The characters are, you know, hang a holdovers from the 70s, very, you know, open-minded sexually. You get an Hispanic-type character and an African-American character, and then you get Jackie Vernon. Those are the main three construction workers, and you know, they mix it up.
Well, and you get the super effeminate muscle gay guy.
Oh yeah, that's
he's kind of like he's the fourth construction guy, just to round it out.
Yeah, yeah, that's also not repulsive at all. It's again, so cliched, and
I love the scene where they have the chick touch his chest. Yeah, and he just loses it.
He's like, ooh. It's like, what is that noise? I told you not to do that.
Be nice.
So like I said, so cliched. So again, it's that type of comedy. It's really bad. I mean, the Jackie Vernon character, it's hard to feel sorry for him because he's such an asshole to his wife. His wife's such a shrew.
I think that's the one thing that where they, you know, you kind of get behind him a little bit. Yeah, he's a complete sad sack, you know, from the word go. But at the same time, yeah, his wife is such a shrill harpy.
Yeah.
That you kind of like, you know what, man, I get it a little bit.
Yeah, you feel so bad for him in a way. She's just so, ugh. But then their relationship is just like, oh, my God, it's so terrible.
Yeah.
Anyway, let's get into the movie a little bit more. We got the opening sequence. We got that out of the way. Then we see my note is, of course, that crab sandwich. yeah, you'd never seen a crab sandwich quite like this one.
No.
We should also mention that the microwave oven in this film actually gets a credit itself.
Yes.
It's played by
Major Electric.
Yeah, it's played by Major Electric. The X1-74A. Microwave. Now there was an era when, and some people still believe this, and you know, teach their own. There was an era when, you know, microwaves. A lot of people worried about microwaves. Of course, you know, back in the old days, people with pacemakers and stuff, which kind of comes into play in this. I won't get into it too much detail, but, you know, there was these things about microwaves and about microwaving food and all that good stuff. And, you know, the microwaves become such a normal part of everybody's lives that nobody really talks about it anymore. And, you know, whatever. And if you don't want to eat microwave food or you don't want to use them to warm food up, that's your thing. They are quite convenient, if you ask me.
They are. So. I don't think that you're going to – I mean, I've seen kind of people do their thing where it's like that's how they cook. I mean, that's like their shtick. Uh-huh. I have never been able to do that. I usually wind up trying shit out. So
yeah,
I can't imagine that a guy like Jackie Vernon is going to be able to make these masterpieces in his microwave.
No.
And they've all – you know, and let's be honest – I used to work on appliances, so I've been around a lot of radar ranges, as they used to be called, and they were big. Don't get me wrong,
yeah,
but they were never this elaborate or this this user friendly. And they were never, you know, that. I mean, this thing is like a fucking built-in oven. So,
oh yeah, well that's
I've never seen one that big.
One of the interesting things about the set they use is there's about four other ovens.
Yep. Yeah, but did you see that each one has like a label on it, like bake, broil, something else?
I think they all rhymed with flambé, soufflé. So I think they all rhymed, if I remember right. I remember reading them thinking, oh, those are all rhyme. I don't know why I remember that, but that's what I remember. But anyway, I mean, she never uses – I mean, obviously she's a person that wants to cook, but I guess she falls in love with this microwave.
Yeah.
And,
well, you can tell she's also one of these people that's like, you know – I have to do the latest thing because I got to be, you know, hip and
yeah,
that kind of thing. Like
yeah,
keeping up with the Joneses, mm-hmm, kind of, even though they don't, you know, they don't associate with anybody
yeah,
ever,
yeah,
except the fucking dog.
Yeah. And Jackie,
that poor guy.
Yeah. That poor dog, Napoleon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He goes, you do that again, I'm going to show you my Bonaparte. I'm like, what does that mean exactly? Is that a threat or is that disgusting? Well, I don't know.
If he pulls out the peanut butter.
Yeah. I don't know anything about that. Anyway, I thought I heard a door. I thought somebody snuck in behind me here. That would have scared the shit out of me. Literally.
Jackie Irving.
Yeah.
Jackie Vernon. Oh, Christ, it's early.
The fact that he always cooks the arms and the hands and stuff. Makes me think that, you know, that they were aiming that, you know, first of all, that's the body parts they had as props.
Those are the ones that they could find at the prop house.
Yeah. They could have used that as a comment in the movie saying that must be the best, you know, like chicken legs. Mm-hmm. That might have been the best part of the human body to eat or whatever. But that seems to be the thing he's microwaving the most. So essentially what we got here is Jackie's not happy at home. Eventually that boils over. He inadvertently or advertently, depending on, you know, how you look at it, but more in a fit of rage, he kills his wife. It's not a plot spoiler. It's a spoiler of any sort, but he kills his wife. He accidentally takes a taste of the meat, which one of the other weird things he does is he throws all the other good meat away to store his wife in the fridge. But what's bizarre about that to me is, now that he knows she's gone, he can actually cook some good food. Why throw it away to begin with?
Yep.
But I mean, I understand he's going to make room, but still, I don't get that. But anyway, so he inadvertently gets up in the middle of the night and gets a sandwich.
Well, here's the other thing is he pulls a fucking piece of thawed food. What he thinks is thawed out meat that's sitting in a garbage can that he just threw out, and he goes in there, just unwraps a piece of it, and starts eating it.
Yeah. So
what the fuck, man?
Who does that?
I've never been that desperate to eat.
No.
Ever. And I've done some sick shit when I've been drunk, so.
Yeah. I've never been that hungry either. So he unwraps it. He starts biting. It's chewy. It's got bread, too, so it would be thawed out frozen bread. This would taste awful. Let's put it that way.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
He gets a bite. He likes it. And then he realizes through, you know, a little bit of trickery of the way it's held and everything else that he's eaten a hand. So, but he likes the taste. It's one of those things, forbidden fruit, I guess. You know, he gets a taste of it, and he can't help it. We should say there's some fourth wall breakage, too, from Jackie at one point with his wife where he looks at the camera. It's actually quite well done, the deadpan look he gives the camera.
Yeah.
And it kind of works because he talks to, you know, he's basically talking to you the whole film. it's kind of a weird moment, but it works. This is the last film he was in, by the way. We should also mention that. He died 4 years later. But, again, forever will be known as, hey, little girl, you know, the Frosty the Snowman guy.
Happy birthday.
I'll say one thing about this movie. On Blu-ray and everything else, this movie looks better than it has any right to look. I was amazed at how good this looked. And I'm not just talking about the boobs. They look great, too. As a matter of fact, the Blu-ray is so good, in such good shape, you can actually see, I think, scratch marks on the girl's boobs where she's sticking them through the wood. Well, it looks like she might have got gouged a little bit. Oh, I did.
Oh, well.
Some of us, you know, it's a hard job, but it's...
Mm-hmm. Well, you're a detail-oriented guy,
yeah.
So...
Yeah, I am. I am. I'm, you know... I was like, is that pepperonis I just saw? What was that? No, either way, but the... It does look really good. I mean, don't get me wrong. It still looks like a movie that was shot on the cheap, but man, it looks way better than it needs to. Maybe so good that the props, even though you know they're clearly fake, they look unbelievably fake. The head in particular looks really incredibly fake. But, you know, again, bravo to Arrow for putting this stuff out. I think about some of the stuff they're putting out in their later releases. Stuff like this, something else we'll cover later, Slugs. Going back to The Mutilator and Blood Rage and these films that, you know, weren't always critically acclaimed films, surely. But it's fun to see this stuff getting the love and care. And I know we say this a lot, but as a film lover and a film collector, I think it's important that, you know, if somebody's going to put this stuff out and put it out with special features and everything else, that we do support these things, because I think a lot of us want to know what goes on behind the scenes. A lot of us want to know, how do these things come up? How do these happen? I mean, sure, Microwave Massacre sounds like an easy pitch. To me, it does anyway, because like I said, there was a hysteria about microwaves in the beginning. I remember when we got our first microwave. My grandmother and grandfather were like, oh, those things are dangerous. I'm going to stay. I don't want anything cooked in the microwave. And I remember thinking, well, that's so bizarre to me. I wonder if anybody ever thought that way about the first ovens, or that way about the first electric oven, so to speak, with the elements in them, right? Because I know my grandmother was strictly gas. She was a gas. She was a very funny lady. But she was strictly a natural gas cooker. She couldn't stand the idea of cooking with electric.
And, my mother's the opposite, but that's because of a certain incident that happened.
Yeah.
She's kind of blowing her eyebrows back.
Yeah, I saw my grandmother do that occasionally, but she still would stick to the gas no matter what. And, you know, it really just a comfort thing also. I mean, she knew how long to exactly cook something.
Sure. Well, yeah, gas is a lot more consistent.
That's true. And this, you know, electric cooking has never, you know, never got to her. I used to tease her all the time, though, once we moved on and I got older and stuff, and she'd say, oh, no, I have to use gas. I have to use the oven to cook that and stuff. And I'd be like, well, why don't we just build a fire outside and we can just put it on sticks and just eat it out there, you know? And she said, I'll never forget this. She said it probably would taste better. Yep. I was like, well, there you go.
She's not wrong.
Well, she's not wrong. You know, she's not wrong. I've had a hot dog over an open pit. It's pretty good. You know, if you like hot dogs. But, yeah, obviously, Jackie Vernon ate a few hot dogs in his day. No doubt. But anyway, to get back on point here, we'll talk about the oven. The oven is ridiculous. This is what looks like the largest oven, microwave oven in particular, ever made. It's a beast. I don't think they ever made them this big. I do remember our first microwave being quite large.
Well, they were big, yeah.
Yeah, and quite heavy.
They were never that big.
I remember being very heavy because I remember when it went bad, we got a new one. And by the time we got a new one, they were tremendously smaller. Mm-hmm. And I had to carry the old one downstairs because back then you never threw anything away, right? You know, we're going to fix that. We'll fix that one day. We'll have two microwave ovens. Yeah. I don't know why my mom and dad sound like Edward G. Robinson, but they do. Yeah, you see? Yeah, yeah. Yeah, yeah, there, Rick. Yeah, yeah. Anyway.
Got to put it in the basement, see? Yeah. Just leave it down there. We'll fix it later.
It's probably still in the basement right now, you see. It probably is still in that basement.
It'll be a gas.
Anyway, so I remember picking it up thinking, fuck, this thing is heavy. You know, and so, you know, again, not quite like the microwaves in this movie, or the microwave in this movie, but considerable. They were considerable. I agree. I remember that. Let's get a little bit more into the movie. There's some bad jokes, like I said. The deadpan delivery does help, I think. The film is shot very flat, not a lot of camera movement, very low budget, obviously. The acting is what you would expect for this kind of movie. Like I said, there's a lot of nudity, which was a surprise. I'd forgotten how much nudity is in this movie. He lives next door to a couple swingers, or at least it seems that way. There's a great great deadpan look when he thinks the girl's pissing on the front lawn. I love it.
Yeah, that was okay.
That was pretty good, yeah. That's probably the way I would react to if I thought that somebody was.
And of course, the neighbor also uses her vibrator to plant seeds, because, which is what you would do.
Because that's what you do, right?
Yeah, and I'm thinking to myself. Then she goes and she puts it in her mouth, and I'm like, "What the fuck? You better hope there's no fertilizer on that lawn, man."
I'm actually surprised it isn't one like a full size like rubber dong, you know, that she's dealing with instead of one of those little handheld.
One of the double siders.
Yeah, one of the actual vibrators that probably most people own. Not to say that, unlike in porn movies where they own these, you know, giant rubber monstrosities. Where do you hide that shit, you know? Most people want a discreet one you could just stick in the sock drawer. You see? Yeah, yeah.
Put it in the sock drawer.
I'm going to go outside and plant some seed here, yeah?
There's some amazing Cagney and Robinson now.
I think we are, yeah.
You dirty vibrator.
Yeah. Oh, you don't taste quite as good as you should.
I'm so hungry, I could eat a whore.
It really is that kind of movie, yeah. I mean, I can remember watching this with my buddies growing up, and we didn't laugh very much, but of course we did like the nudity. But
oh, yeah.
You know, because, I mean, some of the girls are actually pretty good looking. The girl that's in the knothole girl, she's a good looking lady. The Anna Marlowe, she's actually the only few other ones that has a picture on her IMDb. She plays one of the, I don't think she's one of the hookers. I think she's just one of the girls he meets. Or maybe she is. But she's Greek. She's pretty. Kind of a bit of a stunner. She was in a few other things, it looks like. She was in Beyond Evil and something called Box Office. The Dating Game, of course, on TV. She looks like one of the girls that would be on The Dating Game. And some of the other ones, they look pretty good. I mean, I think I've seen them in other stuff, but I didn't do a whole lot of research on everybody in the movie. But, you know, Jackie's, you know, he's horny. And, you know, he's having a good time. And he's not only found his appetite, he's found his sexual appetite again as well.
Mm-hmm. And we get to see it.
Yeah, we get to see a lot of it, yeah.
You get to scratch, watching Jackie Vernon get it on off your bucket list.
Yeah.
After seeing this movie. Which takes, I know that's high up there.
Yeah, another great line in the movie when he feeds one of the sandwiches to one of his buddies. And they're like, this is a tummy turn-on, man. I don't know if I've ever used the words tummy turn-on. I mean, I love me some food, don't get me wrong, but tummy turn-on is not something I'm going to say. Although I might say it from now on going forward. I think this movie, I'm not positive because I didn't get to watch the documentary, but I think it's supposed to take place on the East Coast, but it's obviously shot in Los Angeles.
I don't remember them saying anything about it.
Yeah.
Off the top of my head.
I feel like with Jackie and with some of the way the other guys are talking and stuff, I don't feel West Coast as much as I feel East Coast, but.
I did. And but that's mostly from the exterior, you know, the trees and that. You can always tell from the trees, right? Mm-hmm. They always have like those palm kind of, not necessarily palm, but like palmy trees.
Anytime they were walking around the city, or the quote unquote city part of this movie, the bar areas and things like that. That's when I really got a strong Los Angeles vibe with the roads and some of the suburban stuff. Because I mean, you'd have to live way out really to be in the East Coast to get that suburban. But I mean, in California, almost everything looks suburban. In some way. So, I wrote that down as a note to check it out. But, of course, I wasn't surprised to find out that it was shot in Los Angeles. And one other thing I'll add to the movie, because it's a very simple plot premise. And if you're into watching Jackie Vernon get it on, have a good time, you're into some boobs, and some basic goofy rubber limb cannibalism, then I think you'll be fine with this movie. I want to listen to the commentary on this really badly. I didn't get a chance to.
Yeah, I'd like to.
But one of the things I will say about this movie, I think killed by or at least knocked out by croissant or bread loaf maybe a new thing for this show. I don't think I've ever had anybody taken out with a piece of bread before.
I don't think so.
Yeah, that might be new for this show. I don't really know if that's very common, but at one point Jackie grabs a what looks like an oversized croissant, or possibly it's not a baguette, it's too fat. As stupid as that sounds to say, but it's too large. It looks like maybe an oversized croissant of some sort, or some kind of loaf he's making in his gourmet kitchen. And he takes out the wife's friend, but he's not going to. What I like about that is there's a payoff with that, and I'm not going to get into it. Which actually kind of works. I think overall with this movie, I think 3.8 as the overall score on IMDb. I understand that from a certain aspect, but I don't think this movie, for what it is nearly as bad.
No.
As that. If you like we said, if you know what you're getting into from the beginning, from that first 5 minutes, 10 minutes. If you get
it, don't even have to go that far.
Yeah, if you can get past that, then that's the whole. That's essentially the whole movie, mm-hmm. And it's you know, as Jackie would say, it's not bad. There we go.
Yeah, that's all right.
Save my Jackie for the end there.
Nice. Okay, so yeah, we talked about. The tit window, the reactions. His wife loves the new microwave to the point that, you know, as she's walking by the old box of it sitting in the driveway waiting to get thrown out, she gives it a little kiss.
Yeah.
just to show you how.
So maybe somebody planting seeds with vibrators next door isn't that strange.
Yeah, right? People are kissing microwave boxes. There's the black guy with no rhythm scene.
Oh, yeah.
I thought that was pretty funny. That was kind of like a little Cleavon Little kind of Gene Wilder moment, I thought.
Yeah.
Between the two of them. I got a kick out of that.
I like those two characters together. I wish they were in the movie more.
Yeah, no, they do work pretty well, actually. They actually work surprisingly well when they're not being like horn dogs.
Yeah, like the first time you see them, you're like, oh, I'm not gonna like these characters at all. But then as they go on.
Like Dick's the Jackie.
Yeah. You have a little bit of fun with the way they kind of interact with Jackie and stuff.
But yeah, no, I like them. I like them more or less. You get a young Larry David drunk in the bar. I don't know if you caught that moment.
Yeah.
The guy.
Yeah, I did.
that was all right. And the bartender is one of the most, you know, leave me the fuck alone guys you could possibly ever meet. He likes to tell people about his hemorrhoids to get them to shut up and leave him alone. This is, I mean, yeah, like we've been saying, this is the most leeringest movie ever possibly made. I mean, it just, it loves looking at the women's bits, and yeah, it's kind of what it's all about. One of the lines that I did write down from Jackie is, when it comes to cooking, you'd make a great decorator. So I like that one. That one really, one hit me.
That was a good one.
There's the little liquid fire when his wife drops the match into the bowl of I can't remember what the hell it was, and then she pours water on it, like she sprays water on it. I'm thinking to myself, man, you never fucking put water on a liquid or grease fire, right?
Yeah,
you're just gonna spray that shit all over the place.
She almost does.
Well, yeah, she almost does. Is right, and I'm just sitting there like, dude, you're proving my point, honey.
That was the days when everybody and when I was growing up, I thought everybody had those. Seltzer water bottles.
Yeah.
Only in the movies, really, and in bad comedy shows where those things around, because nobody really cares.
Well,
those.
Jackie Vernon equals seltzer water bottle. So,
I mean, our generation growing up, because we're similar in age, our generation growing up, I think everybody saw somebody squirt somebody with a seltzer bottle, right?
Oh, my God, yeah. Yeah, multiple times a week.
Nowadays, I don't even think.
It's almost a daily occurrence.
I don't even know if they make them anymore.
They probably do.
Yeah, I guess
they
would.
If you go to a restaurant supply store, I'm sure you can get some.
Yeah. Need to get some of those. Be like, hey.
Hey, everybody. We're going to have a seltzer bottles fight.
I might go to jail saying, hey, little girl.
this really, I mean, and we kind of touched on this a little bit. That, like you said, this is a holdover from a different era, and it doesn't feel like an 80s movie at all. And this is largely helped, for me at least, by the music. It's very library music-y.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if there was an actual composer on the film. I'd be surprised if there was, but it feels like library music, and it really just kind of – it really makes it feel like this is a movie from the like mid-70s rather than the early 80s.
Mm-hmm. I'm just looking to see if there's a composer on the film now, so, 'cause I'm curious too. I don't see one, no.
Yeah, so they just sourced all the music from library stuff. Yeah, it's as politically incorrect as it could possibly get. Yeah, like we said, I wouldn't throw out all the food in the freezer to fit my wife in there.
Yeah, we should say this is our – I mean, we have to mention this or we'd be giving off our – I wrote this down in the notes and I skipped it. I was going on my notes. I skipped it actually, but one of the our movie geek card would be remiss if we didn't mention that this art direction is from Bob Burns. Robert Burns.
Nice.
Who quite popular in the horror world.
He's a collector and a scholar, and yeah. I think he did some makeup for some stuff, didn't he?
Yep.
Yeah.
Quite infamously worked on Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Started out right there as art director on Chainsaw Massacre. So those limbs were probably left over. Actually, art director Chainsaw Massacre, Hills Have Eyes, Tourist Trap. looking at these, I'm sitting there thinking, yeah, I think I know where these props came from. Reanimator. yeah, so I think he held on to those props for quite a while.
He served him well over the years.
Yeah. Worked on Disco Godfather, did the special effects on Disco Godfather. So
Nice. let's see here. Oh, there's the Jackie's watching a crime show, and they quote unquote censor the language on it, but they miss just about every curse word.
Yeah.
So you're hearing the fucks and the bullshits and all this stuff. They're beeping like right before or right after. That was pretty funny.
Yeah, that makes it funny.
That was a clever little.
Yeah. That makes it great.
Clever little scene.
I like his face too. He's like watching it like it's an action movie.
You get the hobo nut scratcher.
Those three words you don't expect to hear every show, isn't it?
You'll know it when you see it.
The box art cover. Yeah, the box art cover. Todd from GGTMC says, you get the hobo's nut scratching.
Ringing endorsement. And then, yeah, it just kind of ends, though, the film does.
Yeah.
I mean, it just kind of – it doesn't really have a climax. It doesn't really, you know, have any kind of build up or payoff realistically. It just kind of, you know, ends. It's the most anticlimactic ending I've seen in a long time.
Yeah.
It fits for the story, more or less. Slightly just unsatisfying in how abrupt it is, but still in all, in the grand scheme of things, after the barrage you've sat through for the 70 some minutes, you know, you're perfectly okay with it. And then you got that little, that final shot, which is, of course, just great. I don't think you could surpass that. That's about all I have to say about it, man. I mean, like I said, this is, you know, and not in the pejorative sense, it's a stupid movie. And
yeah, it is.
If you're okay with going along with it, yeah.
This is the definition of stupid, dumb fun.
Really is.
But the fun part can be subjective.
Oh, yeah, your mileage may vary. You said that you'd seen this in the video store and kind of hovered around it. And I'd seen it there too. And I was always just like, that looks so limited in what it's going to give me.
Yes.
That I just always stayed away from it. I was like,
I finally caved. We finally caved. I remember me and my
pal.
This
is my first time watch.
Interesting. And me and my buddy, we finally caved one night. When one weekend, you know, we always go out and rent the horror films. And one weekend, I was like, look, dude. We owe it to ourselves. We got to watch this. We make fun of it every time we walk past it. We got to watch it. What if we're missing a gym?
Yeah, it was either, you know, this and stuff like Fat Guy Goes Nutsoid. It were ones that I always saw the box for, and I was just like, I don't know about that.
Yeah.
But, and when you said we were covering this, I was just kind of like, okay, I'll bite, you know, but it's not something that thrilled me over much. I mean, I could see revisiting this. I could see this, you know, putting this on for like a party tape if you're having a bunch of friends over and you want to watch something dumb.
Yeah.
And certainly that's, you know, that's what it was made for, was, you know, I mean, obviously outside of being in theaters.
Yeah, even then, it's definitely something on in the background, but it's not so much a party movie because even then it's got very much slow moments in between, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, we've talked about this movie almost as long as this movie is. We could have done a commentary track at this point.
Yeah. We could have done it all in Jackie Vernon voice.
Yeah, there you go. Okay, so is that all you got?
That's all I got,
bro. All right, my make or break for this film, pretty easy on this one. It's the opening. It's, again, if you're in for that, you're in for the whole thing. Them boobies. No. The the truth is it's both comical, ludicrous, sexist, and ridiculous, and all those things. But again, if you can get past that, then you can probably have some type of enjoyment with the movie. I mean, him looking over at the neighbor's house alone is pretty good comedy. You know, there's a lot of good bits there. I like that they kept going back to it. Let's put it that way.
Well, they kept. Yeah, it was like a little. It was a little running gag that they just kind of keep flipping around.
Yeah, I like that. There's even one point where he's looking over there, and some girl puts her breast up against the window, and you can clearly on Blu-ray, you can clearly see she left her tit prints on the window. I was like, "That's nice." There we go. I had to rewind that. I was like, "Are those tit prints?" And sure enough, they're tit prints. Good old Blu-ray.
Picking up on the tit prints and the tit scratches.
Yeah, sometimes, you know, that's the way movies work for me.
That's okay.
Call it the id. There's something in the brain that, you know.
The tid.
The tid, yeah. Oh. You. Yeah. Anyway.
I don't know, man.
We're really going back to our, like, Hollywood Squares era comedy here.
That Shecky Green-esque, you know.
Todd in center square. Sammy. Top left corner. Yeah. Ooh. Anyway.
Which one of us would have the ventriloquist doll, though? You really got to wonder.
Whichever one that has the hole in the bottom. Yeah, anyway. That's the open. That's my make or break. MVT. I'm going to go with Wayne Berwick. I mean, I've only seen one of his films. I'd imagine the other one's probably, I don't know, maybe entertaining. I might check out The Naked Monster. Great title. So, I mean, I might check it out at some point. I don't know if it'd be as good, quote unquote, as this one is. I'd give this one just a standard 6 out of 10. I think it's totally passable. I think it's totally watchable. I don't think it's great. I do think it's dumb. But it's kind of fun in that weird way that this era of movies this is. I mean, I've seen much worse. Let's put it that way. Much, much worse than this.
Yeah.
I do think the title's pretty terrible, but I understand the title because it's an easy sell, especially in 82, 83, right? So,
yep.
There you go.
Everything should be a massacre back then.
Yes. And whatever people are scared of, you know?
Yeah. make or break? Yeah, it's the opening credits. I mean, it's no contest, even remotely. MVT, for me, it's the lighthearted tone of it. It's just so, you know.
Part of me wanted to give it to Jackie Vernon because, I mean, you know, he's not great in the movie. He's not a great actor at all.
No.
But somehow by the end of it, I was kind of like, oh, I kind of miss Jackie.
Yeah. No, you get used to him, and then, you know, you kind of just go along with him. And that's kind of the movie is, you know, once you get past the initial shock of what the fuck you're seeing, you kind of get to the point where you're like, oh, okay, I'll ride along with this one. And that's really what it's greatest asset is. It gets you to go along with it if you're willing to. If you're going to be kicking and screaming, yeah, no. The lighthearted tone is the MVT for me. And the score for me is a little bit higher than yours, a 6.5 out of 10. I agree. You can't say it enough times. I mean, it is exactly what it is on its surface. It's not incredibly deep. There's a little bit of commentary going on, but it really doesn't give two shits about it in the long run. It's really more there to entertain and entertain in the broadest possible sense that it can, and it does it well. So that's where I would that's where I'd put this one.
Yep. All right, so that's our thoughts on Microwave Massacre, another interesting release from Arrow Video. We're going to take a short break. We're going to come back and talk about Vamp from 1986. We'll be back right after this.
A one, a two, a one, two, three, four.
Tom Waits here. If you want to hear a really professionally recorded podcast promo, then I'd suggest you go elsewhere. But if you want to listen to a podcast where there's a whole lot of interesting talk about favorite and great albums and what makes the songwriting so fantastic, then I'd suggest you listen to Love That Album, hosted by Mars. Now, if only he'd talk about one of my records.
Whoa, 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 whoa.
Love That Album Podcast.
as endorsed by 1 out of 5 Tom Waits impersonators. You can get the podcast from iTunes searching for Love That Album, or you can get it from lovethatalbum.blogspot.com. Listen to this podcast, accept no imitations.
Everybody, welcome back. All right, so our next film, 1986's Vamp, directed by Richard Wink, that Dick Wink, thereby. oh, man. You wake up in the morning, the first thing you think to yourself is, I'm going to say Dick Wink today. anyway.
Yeah, Dick Wink in the morning is exactly what I needed.
Yeah, I don't think you want it to wink. You want it to be nice and open in the morning. Just winking while you piss, you're going to be all over the place.
Well, you could replace a letter in there and have it be a little bit different.
Yeah, there we go. Yeah. Dick Wank.
I wasn't going to say it.
The plot synopsis for Vamp is as follows. Two fraternity pledges travel to a sleazy bar in search of a stripper for their college friends, unaware it is occupied by vampires. This one on the box said a frightening comedy. I remember that back in the day. I saw this at the drive-in. How about that? It stuck with me over the years. I don't know if you wanted to lead on it. Had you seen this before?
I did back in the VHS days.
Oh, okay. So I didn't know if you wanted to lead on it or...
I could if you want. It doesn't matter.
That's fine with me. Go ahead.
Yeah. You get... Let's see. Okay. Yeah, like I said, I'd seen this back in the VHS days. And obviously, it's going to appeal to somebody who's, 13 years old because...
Yeah.
Women and monsters. So it doesn't – well, I'll get to that. You get a great opening score on this thing with a nice little twisty opening scene.
Mm-hmm.
And it really sets the tone. Again, it's one of those movies that gets it. You know, it knows from the beginning to give you what it is up front so you know what it is you're going in for. And I think this does that well. Keith and AJ, who are the two main characters played by Chris Makepeace and Robert Roessler.
Yeah, I think it's his name.
Respectively.
If you don't know him, you definitely have seen him.
Oh, you know Robert Roessler. Yeah.
Yeah.
He's the quintessential 80s dick guy. And especially in what would have been the big one would have been probably Weird Science, right?
Weird Science would probably be the big one, yeah.
Yeah, that would be probably the one that you would recognize him the most from. Chris Makepeace, obviously, you would know from Meatballs and My Bodyguard.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't really do a ton of stuff, and then he kind of disappeared.
I think he retired from acting or something. Actually, it was really nice to kind of see him in the documentary here. He actually even mentions that he doesn't really do this kind of thing anymore, so he kind of came out of the woodwork to do the interview
documentary. I don't know what he does now, but, hey.
I don't know what he does now either.
I'd love him if you want to get away from it, if it's not your thing.
Well, I mean, he was basically known as a kid actor.
Yeah.
Kind of had that kind of innocent look and stuff, and he did 22 things, but I'd say, yeah, I think I saw Meatballs, My Bodyguard, and then Vamp. What Vamp was 6 or 7 years after My Bodyguard, and then he did a few things after that, TV shows and a few movies. I think he was in the Terry Fox Story, where he played Terry's brother or something. Maybe I can't remember that movie, but anyway, he. He He just, I think he just walked away. I wonder if it even says on his IMDb, but I know he just kind of walked away from the business. He just kind of,
yeah,
probably wanted to do something else.
And, you know, you can't really blame him for that. Yeah, these two guys, I'll be perfectly honest, you know, they are not, they're not the nicest guys in the whole wide world.
No.
They're kind of dicks, yeah. To be perfectly honest about it.
They had good chemistry, though.
They did have good chemistry. They had really good chemistry. But yeah, I mean, they're kind of, they're a little on the douchey side.
Yeah,
they're charming. They're charming enough to to get us into the movie.
And they're shitheads. They're definitely shitheads.
Yeah.
I mean, their whole point is to get into a frat, and you know the frat is obviously full of shitheads.
Yeah, yeah.
So you know, it's just
their cassette gets eaten. Which is always, that was one of the worst things that could happen back then.
Back then, you're right, it was.
Oh my God, how many tapes have I had that, you know, got chewed up and I was like, you motherfucker!
Yeah.
I can't tape that off the radio now. Because that was the whole thing.
Yeah.
You taped it off the radio or else you didn't hear it.
That's right.
Well, you went out and bought it, didn't you?
Yeah. Yeah, that's
screw
what it
that. Screw the man. Actually, the three characters in this thing that I liked more than the leads are the Getty Watanabe character, Duncan.
Yeah.
The Dee Dee Pfeiffer character, who I think was named Allison.
Yeah.
And the Sandy Baron character, a.k.a. Jack Klompas, what was his name? Vic, who was kind of the doorman at the After Dark Club where these guys wind up going.
Mm-hmm.
And if I had to pick out of all three of them, I would say Vic is the best of those three.
Yeah.
Like I said, these three characters are really kind of more interesting because, you know, Vic's kind of like this goofy Vegas guy. You know, he's like a Vegas asshole with the puffy, you know, frill shirt and the pink tuxedo. And that's his whole thing is, he wants to go to Vegas. He wants to move their outfit to Vegas. And by the way, if you get a heavy whiff of From Dusk Till Dawn in this thing, there's not, I don't think, unwarranted.
Coincidence? I don't think so either.
Yeah. And although I would say that this is far less action-oriented than From Dusk Till Dawn is. And if I'm going so far, you know, I don't know that – I got to find my notes so I make sure that I'm thinking of it the right way. Come on, where the fuck is it? Oh, this is the worst.
this is the worst.
This is the worst thing that's ever happened to me. It's not really horror or action or comedy, right?
Mm-hmm.
It just kind of plays all three of them.
It's kind of a wacky one night type movie too. You know, there's a lot of these in the 80s.
Yeah, yeah, and that's, you know, that's why this one doesn't work for me as much as I want it to, and didn't work for me from Jump Street. I mean, from the first time I saw this up through the second and third and fourth time that I saw it. And that's not to say I don't like it.
Mm-hmm.
But it never worked for me as much as I really, really wanted it to, because it never really gives you enough of any one thing before it's jumping to something else.
Right.
I'll give you a perfect example is that, you know, I think it's a bad idea that they kind of stop what they're doing, leave the strip club, go somewhere else, and then come back to the strip club, because it just it kills. You're like, what the fuck, man? These guys are supposed to be in a strip club and they're supposed to be getting, you know, they're supposed to be vampires here, and then they just get up and leave, and then they go back, and then there's the other thing where there's the guy, the bouncer guy who. He's like a big, you know, Italian kind of looking guy who I can't remember his name at all. He keeps seeing Chris Makepeace wandering around, you know, seeing stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And then Chris Makepeace just keeps going back into the strip club. And then he goes to the bathroom in the strip club. So it's like, you know, if you know these guys are on to you, if you know that they're watching you and all this other sort of thing, you know, why would you go back in there to begin with? And then why would you go to the bathroom?
Yeah.
In there.
Yeah.
You know, just like acting like everything is still, you know, we're still here to get a stripper to impress our asshole frat guy friends.
Yeah. As far as common sense, there's not a whole lot.
No, there really isn't.
I think the things that I like the most about this movie is, first of all, the cinematography.
Oh, it's very nice.
Yeah,
very nice.
I like that quite a bit because it's it really is that kind of mid-80s.
Argento.
Yeah, that mid-80s kind of neon look. I think Will would really – I don't know if Will ever saw this or not, but I think he would really the look of this movie.
Oh, absolutely.
And I think that what I kind of did like is I like how kind of – this is a silly thing, but I like how – you know, essentially they're driving and they lose control of their car. Mm-hmm. And I always like the setup of, you know, going somewhere. In this case, in this case, you're leaving the backwoods kind of nice college area to go into the city. But I like, you know, that there's this wrong turn aspect to it, right? There's this, you know, they do a couple, well, not a couple donuts. They do about 15 donuts. And in this big Cadillac, and the next thing you know, they're in the middle of this, what looks like almost a post-apocalyptic part of the city.
Yep.
With neon lights and little girls running around in the middle of the night with baby dolls. And for some strange reason, I enjoy that setup so much that I was willing to, I'm willing to buy that part of it, but I'm with you in the part that, you know, obviously they keep going back because they're limited to sets, I guess. So they keep going back, and that part is kind of watching it this time is kind of bothersome.
I get the reason why. I just think that it probably could have been written a little bit better, or just leave them in the one spot and do something with that rather than having them leave and go to this hotel and do. It's like it just killed the pacing for me, and I know that, you know, hey I'm wrong. I don't know.
In this week's weird ties together type moment. The actress with the one that's hanging out with Billy Drago at one point with the really bad teeth, eating the sucker.
Oh, yeah.
She was actually in Disco Godfather, which, oddly enough, Burns, who did the production art on our production work on Microwave Massacre, did the production work on Disco Godfather.
Talk about 6 degrees, man.
Who knew that was going to happen?
Six degrees of Dick Wink.
Yeah. 6 degrees of Dick Wink and a Disco Godfather. Yeah.
But let's see here. It's basically a teen sex comedy plus horror film, more or less.
Yeah.
I like that Getty Watanabe, when he sits down, he's offering the guy's food. And he goes, manja, manja. I got a little kick out of that.
Yeah.
But yeah, like you said, you get the little mystic portal thing with the car spinning around. And then even one of the guys says, you know, I don't think we're in Kansas anymore. The obvious little call there to Wizard of Oz, even though this isn't that. But then you get some nice. There's some nice little humor touches, like when they're in the little cafe there, when they meet Billy Drago and his two girls there for the first time. You get the cook putting on the priest outfit with the giant cross as he's getting ready to close the place, just so you can get by.
Drago looks great too. He looks great as this kind of albino. Yeah. I don't think he's a vampire, but he's kind of like this albino wanderer.
And he's got the Edgar Winter gang. Yeah, you know. They're all albinos.
And Drago looks – he's got such a striking look anyway. He just looks – you know, he looks like he just totally fits in. Mm-hmm. A bit of an Escape from New York vibe too. We should mention that film as well.
That's in there, definitely.
Yeah, with the kind of – you know, there's a bit of Dutch angle work in here. You know, that kind of canted angles type deal and stuff. So
Yep, I wrote that down. Dick Wink. Low angles, Dutch angles. Yeah. It's another world once they get there.
Yeah, Dick Wink was going for all of it there.
Mm-hmm. Billy Drago and his guys is another thing where I'm just like, you know, I get why they did it. It feels more like something to just kind of drag out the runtime than anything else, or to give them something more to play off of. I don't know that it necessarily works as part of the movie on the whole, although it works for the pieces of it that it's in, if that makes sense.
Well, I think
those scenes work well enough to give them something additional to have to be, you know, getting to be escaping from.
Yeah.
But I don't think it necessarily works in as much as it does anything for the movie at all, other than be something more, just to be another obstacle, right?
Yeah. Something happens to one of the central characters kind of early. And for me, that kind of hurts the movie a little bit, because I think the camaraderie between the three leads is just starting to build to a nice, a nice kind of, you know, us against the world type vibe.
Yep.
And then it kind of throws a wrench. Not that there's anything wrong with the wrench it throws in there. I just think it throws it kind of early.
Yeah. No, I would agree with that. I would agree with that 100%.
When I first saw this movie, I saw it at the drive-in, and I quite enjoyed it. Everybody knows I have a weird Grace Jones fetish anyway. Mm-hmm. She does have a very sexy dance in the film. I guess that depends on who you're talking to.
Yes.
for me, it works, especially when she lays on the chair and shakes her ass. That's quite nice.
She's got an absolutely striking look.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And a very striking performance. But let's be perfectly honest about this: she's no stripper.
No, she's not. No, this is not a strip dance. This is Grace Jones.
And as a matter of fact, I think Keith Haring did the art and the body paint on this. Mm-hmm. If I'm not mistaken,
yeah. I'm not positive, but you. I'm pretty sure
he did.
Yeah, but she is, I agree with you, more than anything else. It's the striking look. The camera loves her because of her angular face. And, or, you know, love her or hate her or be attracted to her or not, she's such a striking-looking person.
Yeah.
Well, nobody looks like Grace Jones, right? I mean, she's just one of those type of people that even people who see her to this day. I mean, they're like either repulsed by her or completely turned on by her or whatever, but she just has this look that's kind of hard to define.
Yeah. Well, now I'm going to let everybody down and say that, yeah, she's never done a single thing for me.
No, I don't think you're going to let anybody down. I think you're probably more than normal. She never really did much for me either, but every now and then.
I really like her individuality. Mm-hmm. I like that she's her own thing through and through 100%. Don't give a fuck about anything. Love that.
Yeah.
But maybe a little too self-serious, maybe about it. That's,
yeah, maybe a lot too self-serious.
And the other thing is that just physically, she just doesn't really – not my thing.
Yeah.
Not that – if it turns you on, go for it.
Certainly not the opposite.
She's a little too stringy muscular for my personal taste.
She's the complete opposite of the girl at the beginning of
Microwave. I know that if anything ever – I'll be perfectly honest – if anything were to happen between Grace Jones and I, would I go along with it? Hell yeah. Would she snap me in half and use me like a toothpick? Yes, she would. and that's kind of also part of the appeal. But at the same time, would she be my first choice? Honestly, no. So it's one of those kind of things where you're appreciating what she is and all that sort of thing. But at the same time, you're like, just not my cup of tea. And it's always been that way for me with her. This is a woman who, butts heads in Conan the Destroyer. So, give her credit for that. But at the same time, So that's my Grace Jones, critique. I will say this, she's very good in this, acting with absolutely zero lines.
Mm-hmm.
She does it's more or less attitude, right?
Right?
And the way that she acts with her eyes, she's very, very, very alien,
mm-hmm.
Which was always Grace Jones' thing anyway. But at the same time, it works very well here because she's, so disconnected from human beings at this point. And you get that the sarcophagus in her dressing room.
Yeah.
Which gives you it pretty much tells you all of her background. You don't really need to know any more about her than that. But the way that she plays it without saying anything, just these looks and this kind of pompous, chin up kind of, leering down looking down her nose at everybody and, letting them know what has to be done with just her eyes and her expressions is very well done.
Right.
So, high credit to her as far as that goes. Mm-hmm. And plus, she relishes, what she gets to do, and even when they put her in the Greg Canham makeup, which I really like in this. I think Greg Canham did a great job as the makeup effects guy in this movie. You could see her just digging into it there too. She's totally getting it. She totally gets that she's an animal and just going in for the kill. And I think that really, really works for this.
Yeah, yeah.
I would have liked to have seen more of that sort of thing, not just for the Grace Jones character, but for the other characters as well, which I don't think you get as much of as I would like in this movie. You do towards the end kind of get it, but then it just kind of just not enough there for me 100%. Not enough to hate it by a long shot, but still. So that's that little piece of it for you. I like the After Dark conversation with Makepeace and AJ and Roosler. Well, they're talking about, well, how do we know it's after dark? It's dark now. Maybe what's after dark? What's it? This is dark. Yeah, so is it now after dark?
Yeah.
I like that. That's one of those little things where you kind of, you know, that you strip away their dickishness.
And that almost feels like it's straight out of like a Tarantino movie before Tarantino came around, right?
Yeah, yeah. Yep, yep.
Those little conversations, and that's what I mean.
Tarantino had this movie on repeat.
Yeah, I mean, there's just great moments where I wish there was more of those three guys just kind of bickering and kind of talking bullshit, because that's some of the stuff that works the best.
Yep, yep. You get the Getty Watanabe and the classic Banaka mist spray, which you can't go wrong with that moment.
You never go wrong with the guy that thinks he's cool with the Banaka breast spray.
And he misses his mouth every time. I love it.
He does the old double spray to the side, and he's like,
come on, guys.
Getty Watanabe, what a character actor. I mean, a lot of people will know him as one character and one character only for most of his career.
Long Duck Dong.
But the truth is, he's had quite an extensive career. I mean,
I like him.
He still pops up and stuff all the time.
Mm-hmm. No, I like him.
I do too.
And I liked him a lot in this. I mean, like I said, he's one of the three most interesting characters in it. You get the stripper with a whip. I'm just saying, stripper with a whip.
There you go.
So that was kind of nice. I think her name was Cimarron,
mm-hmm.
but I don't remember 100%. I didn't get to write it down. I didn't quite hear it clear. And then Dee Dee Pfeiffer is a little bit Leah Thompson, a little bit A.J. Langer. She's the ultra cute, ultra bubbly girl. And she kind of, you know, her being in the After Dark Club doesn't make any sense because of the way that she is. But at the same time, it's nice to have her along for the ride. She's the romantic interest.
Yeah, she's very very cute and bubbly.
Right? Yeah, exactly. Yeah, she just kind
of
She's
very
just,
Streets she's of Fire, too, we should say.
She's the worst timing in the world. You know, she stops. They're trying to get down into a manhole cover, and she stops him Makepeace to tell him where he knows her from, because he doesn't remember when they first meet in the bar. And what they do a couple of times throughout the movie is, you know, drop little hints like, is she a vampire? They don't play it up. They don't, you know, they don't make a big deal about it, really. I think they use it to pretty good effect, is, you know, they play up whether or not she's one of the vampires since she worked at the strip club, which was nice. But, I mean, you know from Jump Street that she's not. I mean, let's be fucking honest, because she's so, you know, so happy and all that other sort of thing. She's too saccharine-y sweet to be anything else. Because in this movie, you know, vampires are, you know, dour, kind of frowny
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
people.
Yeah, vampire is a very serious monster, right?
Yes.
They're always just sitting around moping. And
yep. Like I said, it slips a little bit moving the action out of the strip club. That was the pace killer for me. If I have a major complaint about the film, that would probably be it, aside from how it doesn't quite serve up as much of what I wanted as it gives me. It's still there. But
mm-hmm. You heard me say it a second ago, but a little bit, you know, this comes after Streets of Fire as well, and it gets a little bit of that vibe going as well, whereas I can't really tell once they get to the city what time and place it's taken. You know, I mean, obviously it's another world, right? So I kind of wish it would have had that all from the beginning. But I kind of also, in a weird way, like that it goes from the quote-unquote real world into this fantasy world.
Yeah.
I did get a Streets of Fire vibe from the movie, but especially with the Dee Dee Pfeiffer character.
Definitely. Talked about the angles, the lighting, the sets. Great scene between AJ. There's the scene between AJ and Keith in the dressing room was really good. We get a bit of development, a bit of heartfelt guy bromance-y stuff going on, and you know, for as much as they're kind of tools throughout the majority of the film, you get some nice humanizing in this scene.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And you'll know when you see it. And then I was really happy that they stayed away from staking in the film.
Yeah.
No, they stuck more to burns, right? Mm-hmm, it's mm-hmm. more fire than yeah. anything else in this one.
And
I really liked it. They did a great job on the burns in this movie.
Yeah. The burn they do set great. Up the bow and arrow early, which I like too.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
That's yep. nice.
Yeah. No, nice little foreshadowing. It plays it, you know, it plays it down the line and it gives you what you need to know before, you know, it happens. Nice foreshadowing. Pretty well written. It's, you know, you can't go wrong with it. But I mean, like I said, it's just one of those things that I always wanted this to be more than what it is.
Mm-hmm.
It's still satisfying. It's still enjoyable. But it never punched its way up to the top tier of vampire movies or vampire stripper movies for that matter, for me. So, yeah, that's pretty much everything I got to say
yeah.
about it.
No.
Kick it over to you, buddy.
All right. Yeah. I mean, I'm in agreement with you most of the way. I mean, there's obviously a personal affection I have for this movie. So I have to be careful and that, you know, I review it honestly because I do have a lot of nostalgia for this thing. Like I said, I saw it at the drive-in. I can still remember that night quite vividly and thinking, wow, this is the, you know, next great vampire movie. You know, I was like 12 or 13, 14 years old. So, you know, it just really hit me at the right time. But going back and watching it now, it is very basic. There are things I like quite a bit, the camaraderie, the look. And then there are things I didn't like some. I didn't like, other than the Sandy Baron character, I didn't really like the world of the vampires that much. It felt like Katrina was obviously the boss and the queen, so to speak. And what I liked about the Sandy Baron character, same thing you did, is I liked that he's this wanton character. He's this character always longing for what he could have had. And
yeah.
it seems
yeah,
like
yeah.
he made a wrong turn himself and got stuck in some stuff. And what I like about his character is he wants so much more, and he even says to the other guy, I can't remember that character's name, the big bodyguard,
the bouncer,
guy. Yeah, that you know, she'll never. I think he's in love with Katrina, and
yep.
I think Katrina probably turned both of them, right? And so he'll never see her more than anything else than a feeding bag or a feeding tube mm-hmm. or a feeding whatever. And that gets him mad and stuff. But
well, you get that great moment in the bathroom with the mm-hmm. bouncer too,
yep.
when he has his shirt off. So, yep.
so you, let you get the sense, yeah, you get the sense that these guys kind of accidentally happened upon it, and now they're stuck with this lifestyle for eternity, which is always
yeah.
some of the best stuff about vampire cinema and vampire literature and stuff. Is this kind of, you know, there's the part of all of us that wants to live forever, that wants immortality, right? Because we're all scared of dying.
Well, but we want immortality when we're young.
Yeah. I think that's a natural human emotion.
Well, no, you want it when you're old, but you want to be young when you're immortal.
Yeah, yeah. So I think there's this natural human attraction to immortality because obviously none of us want to get sick or pass away or maybe it's because of loved ones. You don't want to go anywhere or anything. But there also is this sadness. I've always thought the best vampire stories deal with, you know, them being immortal and then watching everybody else pass away mm-hmm. Because they lose things. So they – You still, the thing about vampires is you still have emotion, but you don't, you know, you don't die. So all these things you lose, I mean, that would, think about that. That would destroy you.
Well, sure. They're sympathetic monsters. And
yeah.
in the realm of things, they're usually some of the more sympathetic monsters
right.
because of their longevity.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
they've seen so many things. Although I will say this about the Sandy Baron character is, you know, for how much he goes on about Vegas and for how old he's supposed to be, I found it kind of odd when he says they do that in Vegas towards the when he's sitting there with the makepeece at the bar
and
I was just like dude you're the fucking Vegas asshole don't you know how they do shit there you're gonna listen to some punk fucking 21 year old
it was an odd moment although I do like the way his face looked when he said it, though because there's this childhood childish glee.
Yeah.
Which you don't get a lot in the movie from the vampires.
Yeah.
Again, the way it looks, the way they use the kind of magenta and the neon green, you know, they're bouncing it off of one wall and then they're bouncing, you know, green and those two colors don't go together. So by counterbalancing those, you really get this sense of being in another world. You do get this kind of Bava-esque, Streets of Fire-esque type of feel with the neon and these colors bouncing off the alleyways and all that stuff. And that's nice. And I like that, you know, I always like movies that take place where you don't feel like there's anybody else that exists. All that exists is this kind of tunnel vision, like main characters versus the bad guys. There's no ancillary characters of all. There's none. I mean, there's not really any extra characters. Snow and his gang is probably as extra as it gets, right? And they're just an added threat to the the whole shenanigans that are going, they're taking place. And it's nice that they're really good in it too. And I like the way they pay off, because at first you might think, well, these guys are vampires as well, but the way they pay it off is kind of cool. And kind of a good moment for Makepeace to see his character, to see what happens with one of them. The film is very 80s. I mean, it is. It gets down into, this is 3 years later than Microwave Massacre, but you still get some very piggish behavior. Although, when it comes from teenagers, it feels different because teenagers, by their nature, are kind of piggish.
Yeah.
I mean, it's inevitable. It's you know, your hormones are raging. It's just teenage boys, me and you have both been one. You can't really explain. When you get older, it's kind of hard to explain how insane your brain would work sometimes, and how you saw females or anybody. I shouldn't just say females, anybody of a sexual nature. You just, you know, I mean, the wind could blow and you get a boner. You don't explain it.
I'm not far off now. Yeah. Not that far off now.
I'm 43 now and I'm tired all the time. Trust me, it takes a little bit more than the wind nowadays.
I mean, I may not be able to do much with it, but it still happens.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, it still happens. Unexpectedly, too.
But, like riding on the over the wheel well on the bus. Yeah. You get the wheel well seat on the bus and you're just bouncing around.
The difference is when you're 43 and it happens out of nowhere, you're sitting there thinking, why is this happening? What am I seeing? Well, what am I doing? You're contemplating.
When you're 43 and it happens, you're usually standing at work. Everybody starts fucking looking at you.
This is true. I had one in a meeting the other day. I'm like, the meeting's over. I'm like, oh, fuck. No. It can't be over now.
I'm going to finish my coffee in this room.
It's the one moment where they're like, hey, Rick's going to bring up something. One more thing, guys. One more thing.
I just have a question. You're like fucking Columbo.
Yeah.
I just got one more question.
Yeah. In my head, I'm thinking about.
One more thing.
In my head, I'm thinking about like butcher shops or something. Something that, something that totally turns me off so I can get this, you know, to go away. We should mention that High Pike's in this film very briefly. He plays the desk clerk at the hotel, the kind of seedy hotel, good old High Pike from Hack a Lantern and so many other crazy performances. But he's in there just ever so briefly. He got a beard. Doesn't even look like him. But he's in it just so briefly. But he kind of feel like he wants a piece of Chris Makepeace. He wants a piece of the Makepeace. They don't use that hotel enough. There's a kind of a false scare in there. That hotel's great, though. They should have used it more. I mean, I love that in a hotel, but it almost looks like an old-school apartment complex, like a project or something. And no windows. It looks, seems very claustrophobic. They could have used that a lot more, I think. The sewers work. A little Burton-esque in some weird ways. You know, Burton would start to get pretty popular around this era, so filmmaking starting to change, becoming much more of a...
Although the sewers are also really, really clean.
Yeah. And really, like really, really large. I don't know if I've ever been in a sewer as large as some of these sewers you see in the movies.
I don't think I've ever been in a sewer.
Well, man, that, I was hoping you would say that. That's a good comedy beat because, sadly, I have been in a sewer before. I don't know why that is either. That's another story for another time. Probably watched too many movies. That might be the problem. Like, oh, let's go down this manhole. And then, of course, you know, as teenage boys do, you joke, we just went down a manhole. And then your one friend's staying in the corner because he's got a boner and you don't know why. Anyway. I think for the era and for the type of material this is, I think this film, I think it stood out for me because I think it was a little different. I remember when From Dusk Till Dawn came out, I liked the idea of strippers as vampires. I thought that was a great idea. And I thought to myself, wow, why hasn't anybody had that idea before? And then I thought, wait a minute, Vamp had that idea. It's a great way to attract young men or young characters or anybody. It's a great way to get, you know, sad sacks or people with no lives into a bar to take advantage of them. So the titty twister being this kind of overblown, kind of goofy version of that, but also being this great idea for bait, for bringing men in, truck drivers and things, and from Dusk Till Dawn.
I mean, yeah, if I was a vampire, that's totally what I would do.
Yeah, I mean, that way you get your food supply, right? I mean, you're always constantly getting it in there. So you want to do something where you're going to attract people. Otherwise, you're going to live a very lonely existence.
Yeah, you want to attract people but not attention.
Yeah. You don't want to be like Dracula living in a big old castle in the middle of nowhere hoping somebody will show up one day.
Yeah.
It's next thing you're licking razors and everything else. Like, but this is – I mean, I did watch some of the documentary on this one, and old Dick Wink, he does say that he had been influenced by Marty Scorsese's After Hours, which you do feel that in the film a little bit. And it does have, like I said, the one crazy night type aspects, which I do adore those type of films, because I do like the idea of, you know, you leave your home, the safety of your home, for a night out with your pals or something. You know, you're stepping away from your normal routine, right? You just, it's good for you psychologically. It's good for you in so many ways to kind of get back out there and act like a young stud, or to be a young stud and get out there and just, you know, be one of the guys. And you know, that's good for you mentally, right? And all this stuff. But I like that it's a great setup for bad things to happen. It's a great reminder that there's safety in being within the four walls you control. I just think that works really well for me. I'm a bit of a recluse anyway, so for me that always works, because I always have these anxious moments when I go anywhere. The shit's going to go wrong. I'm going to get a flat tire. Yep. I'm going to have this. I'm going to have these problems, that problem, you know. I'm going to have, you know, Zom's going to pinch my ass. I'm not going to know where that's going to go.
You're going to pinch the inside of it.
Yeah, right inside, right by the taint. Whoa. Yeah, get way down in there.
Oh, that would hurt too, because it'd be like that. It's that kind of.
It would hurt, but it would be interesting.
Yeah, but it's not like a normal pinch down there.
No, it's not.
It's like an extra hurdy pinch. I don't know how else to describe it.
Like under the arm, like where the sagging meat from the arm.
Yeah.
Like the really, really intense
pinch. It kind of feels like almost like a stab pinch.
If you meet me in person, just stick to the nipples.
Yeah.
All right. Another thing I didn't
think of. I'm ticklish there. Don't do that.
But I enjoyed the movie. I like Grace Jones' performance, because, you know, she is playing a very animalistic character. She has no dialogue. Mm-hmm. The makeup looks great on her because of her face anyway, her angular face. There is something alien and non-human about Grace Jones to begin with. So when they cover in white kind of kabuki makeup and stuff, it just accentuates all that, right? The pink hair and... Yep. And her hair looks almost cartoonish and great when she gets off stage. I mean, she's got this really incredibly stiff and weird hairdo.
Yeah, that, well, it's almost the same haircut that she has on stage. It's just
very,
you know, natural.
Yeah, it almost feels like it's cut out of like cardboard or something. It's mm-hmm, very mm-hmm. bizarre looking. Almost feels like something out of a Guar set.
Nice.
But I really like that. I like the kind of sexuality of the wire bikini. I like the overt sexuality of her character, the way she attacks the Robert Roessler character sexually and basically rapes him, essentially, turning the tables on the piggish, you know, male. I like that quite a bit. There's a lot to be said there. And like I said, I don't think this is a masterpiece by any shape or form, but I think this is a very enjoyable and very rewatchable vampire film.
Oh, yeah.
And would like to see a movie where the bad guys were just Billy Drago and a bunch of albinos chasing some dudes through the streets. That would be pretty good, too.
Yeah.
Got a little bit
hell,
of a
you can even do it today. Look. He's still alive, isn't he?
Yeah. He's in his 70s now, believe it or not, man.
Yeah, he looks pretty good.
Yeah, well, he looks like Billy Drago, right? When you look like Billy Drago, I don't think you can look bad, because you've always kind of looked that way.
Yeah.
It was
a Richard Lynchian kind of.
I mean, when you got to look like him, you're going to work forever. And he's still working. He's working like crazy. I mean, he's never not going to have work, because he has such a striking look, similar to Grace Jones. It was a kind of a coup to cast those actors, because they have such a striking look. And I'm with you. I really fell in love with the Dee Dee Pfeiffer character. I love the kind of – she's cute and sexy and kind of aloof. Mm-hmm. And there's something really appealing about those combinations. And there's an innocence to that too. And I don't want to, cause I want to add that to it, cause I don't want to sound like I'm a pig, but there's the innocence to it that I like.
Yeah.
She's kind of can't believe what's going on. It's been right under her nose the whole time.
Oh, and plus she's kind of like a lower tier Elizabeth Shue.
Yeah.
Who at that point in time was, oh my God, was I in love with Elizabeth Shue?
Oh yeah, I was too.
Mid-80s. Still am. I still am. I still think she's fucking phenomenal.
Yeah, I like her a lot too. Yeah, I like her a lot too. But that Karate Kid Elizabeth Shue and that kind of Adventures in Babysitting Elizabeth Shue. Oh yeah.
But, oh shit, I forgot what I was going to say. Damn it. Oh, yeah, no, even Dee Dee Pfeiffer is still looking good these days. They do the interview with her in the documentary.
And yeah.
She's still looking very, very nice.
And for those of you who are curious, yes, she is related. She is the sister of Michelle Pfeiffer. So
there you go.
There you go. So,
good genes in that family.
Good genes, yeah. They look good in jeans, you're right. I kind of enjoy the fun of the movie, and you know, the closing credits got a disclaimer saying any similarities between persons living dead or undead is purely coincidental. So it's kind of winking at you, a little dick wink, winking right at you, you know. So you know, I think there's, you know, it's that kind of movie. Again, this week, if you're into some horror comedies, I think you could do worse than Vamp and Microwave Massacre.
Yeah, yeah. I would agree with that, 100%.
That's all I got.
All right. Make or break for me is the opening. Like I said, I mean, it pretty much sets up the tone that you need to know going into this thing. And it sets it up well enough. And plus, it has a great little opening score, which kind of works with it to get you into the vampire mood.
Mm-hmm.
The MVT is the visual aesthetics. Yeah, I mean, this thing just looks phenomenal.
Yeah, it does.
So nice from stem to stern, even when they're not in the other world, but especially when they are, obviously. Very, very, very well shot and very well handled from a visual standpoint. Score for me is 6.75 out of 10. I mean, like I said, it's still not top-tier vampire or vampire stripper movie for me, but it's up there, and it's fun, and it's a nice little time waster. I mean, it's not one of those movies that you need to be paying strict attention to.
Yeah.
If you've seen it before, you know, to pop it in, you could always just have it on in the background and it'd be perfectly fine.
Right.
As a way to go through there. And I think, is there a commentary on this disc? I didn't take notice.
Because
if there is, I'd like a little dick wink in my ears.
No, there's not. There's just the one of those nights, the making of Vamp.
Okay.
And you get, some behind the scenes rehearsal stuff, blooper reel.
Okay. Yeah, I watched most of the documentary.
You do get Dick Wink's short film Dracula Bites the Big Apple, which is was pretty celebrated in its day. I remember reading about it in Fangoria and a few other things. So you do get that. You do get that extra little bonus. And I watched some of that. It was pretty interesting. Always interesting to watch early shorts from filmmakers, kind of finding their way and stuff. It's always interesting.
Yeah. No, it is. But like I said, yeah, I mean, you could do a lot worse than Vamp. I mean, I really wish that it hit more of my bits and pieces than it does. But yeah, it's okay too. It's not offensively.
Yeah. Is it pre Lost Boys or post Lost Boys, Vamp? I think
this
it's pre.
Would be pre.
Yeah, because I think Lost Boys is 87, right?
I think it was 87 or 88.
So I feel
it wasn't 88. What the fuck am I saying?
It was 87. Yeah. So Schumacher, I feel like Schumacher saw a little bit of this too, because I feel like the blonde hair on Billy Drago, you know, Kiefer Sutherland, I feel like, you know, there's a little bit of that. Obviously, there's the times. I mean, you could say a lot of these movies are similar in some ways, but I do feel like, you know.
Yeah, I mean, you could say the same thing, you know, any vampire movie is similar to every other vampire movie. I mean, Near Dark would have been, what, 87? So,
yeah.
Right around the same time, and that movie's completely different. Than this one, but the point being,
yeah,
that's all I got on this one, brother.
All right, brother.
Brother.
Let's see here. I'll go. My make or break is the Grace Jones dance. For some strange reason, it works for me. I don't know what it is. My mouth was a gape like the customers when I first saw it, and it stuck with me over the years. And it's still one of my favorite scenes in the movie. It's just so Grace Jones and so bizarre. And it just feels like with her, it's one of those moments where you can just turn the camera on and say, Grace, do your thing. And she does it. And you're just like, what the fuck just happened? You feel like everybody felt that way.
But it's an experience.
Yeah. My MVT, Dick Wink. I like what he did with this movie. It's a very simple concept. I think it was his, if I'm not mistaken, it might have been his first theatrical experience, his first full length. I'm going to check here real quick. He only did six things. Yeah, this was it. Dracula Bites the Big Apple in 79, then 7 years later, Vamp. And then after that, I guess Vamp was a hit as far as budget goes. It was made for $3 million, and I think it made almost $5 million. But after that, he didn't do a whole lot. It looks like he's more of a writer than he was anything else. He wrote 16 Blocks. He did a remake. He did The Expendables 2. Wow, there's a tie-in you didn't expect. The Mechanic, the remake of The Mechanic, the remake of Magnificent Seven. Seems like that's where he's at now. Equalizer 2, Jack Reacher Never Go Back, which got panned quite badly. So it seems like he's picked up his career again. He did the movie that's coming out this year, Renegades, kind of a military movie, J.K. Simmons, and I don't know if you've seen anything about that, but it looks pretty interesting. Like I said, and looks like he's just mostly working in big budget. Big budget stuff nowadays. But good for him, though.
Good for him, yeah.
Yeah, good for him. I mean, he's still working. That's the important thing. He wrote the actual Equalizer. I'm always meant to see that movie. I never got around to it. So.
The movie?
Yeah, the...
it's pretty good.
Oh, it looks like he wrote some working for WWE Studios, too, which, like it or love it, at least, they're making these low-budget, action and horror films. There's not a whole lot of studios doing that anymore. So WWE Studios is doing some of that stuff. Which, like I said, like it or love it, it is what it is. You can equal parts. He did that Andy Garcia, Andy McDowell film, Just a Ticket, about the ticket scalper. I remember that.
Oh, my God. I watched that on a fucking plane once.
He did that movie. That was his second directorial film.
Oh, poor bastard. That was such a piece of shit. Never mind. Yeah, I'm not going to.
Should have stuck with the vamps.
Yeah, buddy. Put vampires in that fucking thing. Vampire ticket scalpers. Give me that.
So anyway, like I said, he's having a good career as a writer, so good for him. Because he deserves it. I think this is a pretty good debut when all things considered.
Yeah. It's
kind of a shame he's not making movies like that anymore. Who's he married to? Is that Mimi Rogers? There's a picture of him on IMDb, and I can't tell who that female is with him, but it looks like...
Let me see.
I don't know. It sort of looks like Mimi sometimes, and then sometimes it doesn't. Who knows? No, that's not Mimi.
No, that's not Mimi Rogers.
I wonder who that is.
I don't know.
Anyway, I'll give it to him. Good for you, Dick Wink. I love your name. It's awesome. Score for me, a little slightly higher than yours, 7 out of 10. Again, I think it's obviously nostalgia, but I do really like the look of this movie, and I do like the one-night films. I think the striking looking actors, Billy Drago, Grace Jones, even Chris Makepeace in his own way. I mean, they don't really make him like Chris Makepeace anymore.
No.
With those striking eyes. I mean, there's one point where the light's hitting his eyes, his blue eyes, that I thought he had contacts in. They were so incredibly fucked up looking. I was like, whoa, is he a vampire? What is going on? But his eyes were pretty amazing. And even Robert Roessler or whatever. I mean, that's one of the great, quote-unquote jock meathead actors of the 80s.
Yeah.
And he's got a striking look himself. A very attractive man. I'll just get that out there, Todd. So, that's our thoughts on Vamp. We hope you enjoyed the show. Yeah, we hope you enjoyed the show this week. Head over to our sponsors, Diabolik DVD. Pick up the Arrow releases. Make sure you pick them up. If you like these two movies, definitely pick these two releases up. If you're just curious, you could do much worse. I can tell you that. They did a great job on these releases, as they always do. There's a reason why we love them so much as a sponsor, because to me, they take the GGTMC approach to films that, don't always get that appreciation. So, mm-hmm.
Yeah, Microwave Massacre being a perfect example.
Mm-hmm. A perfect example. And, I appreciate that more and more. And they're a label that, they're putting out stuff like Cinema Paradiso. They're putting out stuff like the Herschel Gordon Lewis box set. I mean, they're covering the gamut, and that's what we try to do here. It's not all about the one genre. It's about the love of film in general. So that is all we got. I guess there's only one last thing to say, and that would be adios.
Adios.
Yeah, May.
Thanks for listening. You can find the gentleman at
ggtmc.com, and you can email the gentleman at midnightcinema@gmail.com.